When I was a child, I used to have a little tube that was spring-loaded and you could store £1 coins in it. 10 £1 coins. And I was determined to fill this tube. And I used to get £1 a week pocket money. So initially, you think, well, it's only going to take you 10 weeks if you save your pocket money. But I was encouraged to tithe my pocket money, so to take 10 pence out of every pound and put it in the collection at church. So I was always left with a handful of change, 90 pence, trying to work out how I'm going to fill this £1 spring-loaded tube that I've been given. So I decided I'd ask my parents for a raise. Could I have £1, 10p per week? They thought that was reasonable. I was dead chuffed. Until I realised that 10% of £1.10 was 11p, leaving me £1. Still no idea how I was going to fill this tube. Money, I learned that money was quite complicated quite early on. And we're going to have a look at James's letter, as well as a couple of stories from 2 Kings today. And there's a strand of teaching in James's letter that is about our relationship with money and possessions and poverty. And so that's what we're addressing today, our relationship with money, possessions and poverty. And it's quite a hard and difficult, complicated subject for us to get our heads and our hearts around. And my hope and my prayer is that we'll come to this acknowledging God's grace in this really difficult subject, rather than going away induced with guilt. So that's the hope and the prayer, that we'll understand God's grace as we engage with this difficult subject. Now, perhaps you have money, or maybe you feel you lack money. Are you concerned that you have enough to see you through retirement? Are you anxious about putting food on the table this month? Are you saving up for the next holiday, or perhaps for the grandchildren's Christmas presents? Are you overwhelmed about bills or rent or soaring costs? Are you comfortable with the amount of money that you save and spend on yourself and give away? Or is it just a really difficult subject to think about? Our relationship with money can be complex, and whatever we consider our financial status to be, James has something to say to each one of us about our relationship with money and possessions and poverty. Now, the first thing I want to draw out from James is the gospel changes us. The gospel changes us. I'll read the first verse. You don't need to look this one up. But it's James chapter 1, verse 27. He writes, "Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world." I'll read that again. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. Now, of course, religion is not just made up of looking after widows and orphans, but James argues throughout his letter that faith without deeds is dead. In other words, if you say you're a Christian but have no compassion for the vulnerable, you may have missed the point of the gospel. When we discover God's radical generosity of grace, it should completely change us, including our relationship with money and possessions and poverty. So let's take 2 examples from the New Testament of people who met Jesus in the flesh. The first example, in New Testament times, Israel was occupied by a foreign force, the Romans. And a man called Zacchaeus, who was an Israelite, collected taxes on behalf of the Romans. Now, working for the tax office in the UK is something you might not shout about at parties. But working for the Romans as a tax collector was even worse. Zac was considered a traitor. He was working for the opposition. Why would an Israelite do that? Because it paid very well. There were no rules about how much extra tax you could take as a tax collector to line your own pockets. So tax collectors became very wealthy at the expense of their neighbours. Now one day Jesus came to town for some reason. He visited, Jesus came to town and for some reason Zacchaeus was drawn to him. And being a very short man, he couldn't see over the crowds and no one would let him to the front. So you might remember the story, he climbed a tree so that he could see Jesus. And Jesus called him down and to the shock of everyone there, decided to have tea with Zacchaeus, the traitorous tax collector. Our last holiday was in Devon, so I'm imagining them sitting down to scones with cream and jam. I'm not sure what the Israelite version would have been, but by the end of that conversation, God's grace had entered Zacchaeus' heart and his relationship with money had completely changed. Do you know, he committed to giving everyone giving back everything that he'd unfairly taken from others. Israelite law stipulated that such repayment should include 20% of interest. Zacchaeus was so changed by God's grace that he gave back with 300% interest. That's quite a response, isn't it? That was the impact of the gospel on Zacchaeus' life. Let's take a second example. We've got Martha's sister, Mary. She had brought an extremely expensive jar of perfume to Jesus and poured it on his feet as an act of worship. She was essentially saying, all of my worldly goods, my possessions, my financial security, I pour out on you. My money is worth very little compared to you. I put it all at your feet. But the disciples were indignant. Judas said, this perfume could have been sold and used to help the poor. What an interesting thing to say moments before he betrayed Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. He's right, of course. Mary's act showed her relationship with money and possessions was countercultural. But on that occasion, didn't help anyone in poverty. And yet Jesus accepted her act of worship. Her relationship with money, possessions and poverty centered around her number one priority, Jesus. And that's the number one challenge that James presents to us in this strand of his letter. So some questions for us to think on. Is Jesus central to our lives? Are we devoted to him? What does that look like? How does it affect our saving, our spending, and our giving? God's grace should change our relationship with money, possessions, and poverty. And if it hasn't, we might consider whether we've really grasped God's gospel of grace. So that's the first thing. The gospel changes us. The second thing is this. Poverty takes many forms. James's focus on widows and orphans is just one example of vulnerability. And in biblical times, typically, this kind of vulnerability involved material poverty. But poverty can take many forms. Let's turn now to 2 Kings chapter 4, where we see the prophet Elisha encounter two women, one with no money and one with money to spare. And as Dad reads this, you can call him Chris. As Chris reads this, have these questions in mind. Which of these two women were vulnerable? Which of them had great need? Which of them needed a compassionate response? And which of them was on God's radar? And I'll ask you for your response to some of those questions after the reading. So 2 Kings 4, 1 to 17.
Read together. 2 Kings 4, 1 to 17, page 370. Okay.
Let's go. The wife of a man from the company of the prophets cried out to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that he revered the Lord. But now his creditor is coming to take my two boys as his slaves." Elisha replied to her, "How can I help you? Tell me, what do you have in your house?" "Your servant has nothing there at all," she said, "except a small jar of olive oil." Elisha said, "Go round and ask all your neighbors for empty jars. Don't ask for just a few. Then go inside and shut the door behind you and your sons. Pour oil into all the jars, and as each is filled, put it to one side." She left him and shut the door behind her and her sons. They brought the jars to her, and she kept pouring. When all the jars were full, she said to her son, "Bring me another one." But he replied, "There is not a jar left." Then the oil stopped flowing. She went and told the man of God, and he said, "Go, sell the oil and pay your debts. You and your sons can live on what is left." One day, Elisha went to Shunem, and a well-to-do woman was there, who urged him to stay for a meal. So whenever he passed by, he stopped there to eat. She said to her husband, "I know that this man, who often comes our way, is a holy man of God. Let's make a small room on the roof, and put in it a bed and a table, a chair and a lamp for him. Then he can stay there whenever he comes to us." One day when Elisha came, he went up to his room and lay down there. He said to his servant Gehazi, "Call the Shunammite." So he called her, and she stood before him. Elisha said to him, "Tell her, you have gone through all this trouble for us. Now what can be done for you? Can we speak on your behalf to the king or the commander of the army?" She replied, "I have a home among my own people." "What can be done for her?" Elisha asked. Gehazi said, "She has no son, and her husband is old." Then Elisha said, "Call her." So he called her, and she stood in the doorway. About this time next year, Elisha said, "You will hold a son in your arms." "No, my lord," she objected. "Please, man of God, don't mislead your servant." But the woman became pregnant, and the next year, about that same time, she gave birth to a son, just as Elisha had told her.
When we were in Devon, this was my quiet time, and I was really struck by why these two stories were placed side by side in Kings. So let's have a look. Which of these two women do you think was vulnerable? The first one?
Yeah.
The first one definitely was particularly vulnerable, wasn't she? She was in desperate and immediate need. In biblical times, husbands were the breadwinners and the protectors, hence James's concern for widows and orphans. And there was no government aid for them to rely upon. So this woman has nothing. And we can see that she literally has nothing except a dash of oil in her cupboards. Even her sons were going to be sold into slavery to pay the debts that she'd been left with. She could lose everything and die of starvation. Elisha intervenes with a miracle that ends her material poverty and further family loss. But what about the rich woman? Surely she was okay. What do you think? She was clearly wealthy, wasn't she? She even used some of her spare wealth to provide for the prophet, to build him a room in her house so he could use it as he passes by. That's a woman of wealth. And when he wants to help her, she says in verse 13, "I have a home among my people." In other words, I'm secure. I have everything I need. But was that entirely true? What was her great need?
The love of God.
She certainly had a love of God, but what was her great need? What was she lacking? What do we discover she lacks?
A child, family, a son.
That's right. She was perhaps barren. She didn't have a child. We don't know why. She was childless and her husband was old, so soon she would be on her own. She would end up being a widow with no one else. And she desperately yearns for a child. We can see that because when Elisha says that she will become pregnant, she says in verse 16, "No, my Lord, please, man of God, don't mislead your servant." In other words, don't build up my hopes so that I'll just end up despairing with disappointment. But in verse 17, we hear that the woman became pregnant. And the next year, about the same time, she gave birth to a son, just as Elisha had told her. So which of these two women needed a compassionate response?
Both
of them, that's right. And which of these two women was on God's radar?
Both
of them were clearly on God's radar. A question for you to ponder to yourselves. Which of these women do you most resonate with? Do you have a deep need that you desperately want God to intervene with? You are on his radar. The widow faced material poverty. Can we call the rich woman's desperation for a child a type of relational poverty, perhaps? Scripture expresses multiple times God's special concern for those who are extremely vulnerable, like the widow. But there are many types of poverty: material, relational, emotional, spiritual, and more. And all forms of poverty are on God's radar. Now, as a church, or as individuals, we should aim to respond to different types of poverty in our community with compassion and understanding. Because poverty is complex, it's really complex. And we'll need his wisdom, we'll need God's wisdom to help us to engage appropriately with those who need that kind of help. James encourages us, "If any of you lacks wisdom," he writes, "you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you." I think this is a subject we really need wisdom for. If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. The gospel changes us, our relationship with money, possessions, and poverty. And poverty takes many forms. Thirdly, our financial choices matter. Our financial choices matter. Let's have a look at what James writes about that. James chapter 5, verse 1 to 6. Let's read this one together. So it's page 1216, James chapter 5, 1-6. And as we're reading this, ask the question, think about the question, who are the rich? Who are the rich?
Let's read together. "Now listen, you rich people. Weep and wail because of the misery that is coming on you. Your wealth has rotted, and moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You have hoarded wealth in the last days. Look, the wages you failed to pay the workers who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. You have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourselves in the day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the innocent one who was not opposing you."
So who are the rich in this context? Any ideas? Who are the rich?
Landowners.
Yeah, landowners, that's right. In this context, really, the rich, you could broaden that out to people who hire others who are desperately reliant each day on receiving their wages. So the rich are the people that provide the jobs and provide the wages to those who are desperately needing those wages. Those are the rich, and in this case, landowners in particular. However, James is also talking to Christians who have enough money to impact others, and especially to impact the vulnerable. If we've got enough money to buy tea or coffee or a pair of jeans or a pair of trousers, sorry, a pair of jeans or a pair of trainers, then we also fall into this category. Our choice of tea, coffee, jeans and trainers as examples can contribute to the exploitation of vulnerable people who face various forms of poverty on a daily basis. James writes in verse 3, "You have hoarded wealth in these last days. Look, the wages you failed to pay the workers who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty." Now, the last days refers to the period between Jesus' resurrection and his second coming, and we are in that period. Christians should know all about Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, and James condemns Christians who live as if these events never took place, for living as if they need to hoard their wealth, for living as if they need money for their security, for status and power, for control or affirmation. When our deep need for these things are not met in the gospel, James knows that we're willing to tread all over other people to have those things met, to get what we want. Some of our financial choices make a mockery of Jesus' sacrifice on the cross, which is why James goes further in verse 6. "You have condemned and murdered the innocent one who was not opposing you." It's right to be prudent and to make a will, to invest in a pension. But when we hoard, when we're driven by insecurity, a lack of trust that Jesus has got us now and in the future, only deeper reflection on the gospel of grace can solve that. It's fine to spend money on ourselves, making ourselves look presentable. But when that becomes lavish spending, driven by a desire to be loved and affirmed by others, we need to come back to the gospel of grace. So a question for ourselves. Is our need for security, for status, for power, for control or affirmation completely met in Jesus? What do our financial choices say about God's grace in our lives? Now I have a confession. I preached on James 5, 1-6 a few years ago, and I did quite a lot of research at the time looking into ethical spending. I made a commitment to make better choices about the money I spent on the things that I felt I needed. But it can get really hard. It's really hard to get that right a lot of the time. And it's such a complex world that I almost completely stopped bothering. Stop bothering to work out which brands might be more ethical than others, to work out which brands are more responsible and which are the worst perpetrators. If I'm honest, I prefer to distance myself from the problems that are further down the production line. And I suspect many of us prefer to keep such problems at a distance too. Now, in a telling documentary, a presenter visited Nike. You know, Nike made trainers. Visited Nike's CEO and founder, Philip Knight. And he turned up, this presenter of the programme, turned up with two first-class tickets to fly to Indonesia. And he invites Philip Knight to visit the factories that Nike has in Indonesia. And in the programme, Philip just bursts out laughing. "No, not a chance," he says. The presenter asks, Have you ever been to see your factories where your shoes are made? No, he responds, and I'm not going to go. It's this kind of distance that allows injustice to grow. A few years ago, a boy from Indonesia was put on stage at a conference to put a face and a personal voice to the injustices of such factories. And he pointed to a giant scar that ran down his face. "I got this scar," he said, "when my master lashed out at me for not working hard enough. And when it began to bleed, he did not want me to stop working or to ruin the cloth in front of me. So he took a lighter and he burned it shut. I got this making stuff for you." So poverty is personal. Our financial choices reflect our faith. When we're looking at a bargain, consider, why is it a bargain? Who might be losing out that I might make this small win? Now a few years ago I downloaded an app, I started reading blogs, I read a book on the subject. You can do some research to find a little bit of basic understanding about how to spend money well and who might be the worst brands to avoid. But it is difficult and it's complex when it comes to what we can purchase and what we might avoid purchasing. And I haven't got any easy answers to you other than to encourage you to just do a little bit of digging around to find out where you might buy your tea, coffee, jeans, trainers from. And again, James says, if any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. So let me finish by paraphrasing James chapter 1, verse 27. Don't be polluted by this world. Have a courageous and radical faith that holds money and possessions loosely and serves the most vulnerable with genuine interest, compassion, and understanding. That is a faith that has been genuinely impacted by God's grace. Amen.